Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, January 9th, 2014, during a live telephone conference call. Welcome to the Practice Group telephone conference call. Today we'll be discussing proposed regulations to modify the rules under 501c4. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. We have on our call today three experts, and we'll hear opening remarks from each of them in the following order of about 5 to 8 minutes or so. We're going to hear first from Ms. Cleta Mitchell. She's a partner at Foley & Lardner. She'll be followed by Jason Torchinsky, who's a partner at Holtzman Vogel. And finally, we'll hear from John Pomerantz with Harmon, Curran, Spielberg, and Eisenberg. We're going to begin, as I mentioned, with Ms. Cleta Mitchell. She's going to give us some background. So with that, Ms. Mitchell, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean, and thanks all for joining us. Today we're going to talk about a notice of proposed rulemaking that was published in the Federal Register on November 29th, which, yes, was the day after Thanksgiving. So while everyone was still in a stupor from overeating on Thanksgiving Day, the IRS was in the process of publishing proposed rules that would create a new definition that has not historically existed in the Internal Revenue Code for regulations defining what constitutes what is a new term of candidate-related political activities. I'm going to give a little bit of an overview of the background of how we got to where we are today and what the process is. Then I'll turn it over to Jason Torchinsky, who will talk about a quick overview of what the proposed candidate-related political activities consist of. And then he will turn it over to John Pomerantz, our colleague, who will describe a little bit of the historical background of alternatives and, in particular, a proposal that he and some of his colleagues have been working on for some time called the Bright Line Project. I think I've done that justice, I hope. But let me begin by saying that let me go back in time just a bit, because the IRS has been under extreme pressure essentially since 2010, since the Citizens United decision of the Supreme Court, which ruled that it is constitutionally impermissible to prohibit corporate entities from making candidate-related political expenditures as long as those activities and expenditures are independent of the candidates and campaigns. And since that time, because 501c4 organizations and 501c5s, which are labor unions, and 501c6s, which are trade association business leagues, and all of the other 50C panoply of organizations, in fact, all 501c organizations except for 501c3s, which are charities, all the other 501c organizations are permitted to engage in what the IRS has defined at present as partisan campaign intervention, or even exempt, that's a definition that relates primarily to 501c3s, but the regulations also talk about exempt activities as defined in Section 527 of the tax code. But basically, 501c4s and other 501c groups are permitted to engage in political activities as long as those do not constitute a majority of their expenditures or not their primary purpose. And what began to happen, of course, we know with the IRS scandal related to the Tea Party groups, was that applicants for 501c4 and in many cases 501c3 exempt status were subjected to new kinds of scrutiny by the IRS, trying to ascertain whether, in fact, these organizations were planning to engage in political activities. I mean, that's the shorthand version of what happened with the IRS scandal. And there have been letters from members of Congress, primarily, you know, from Democratic members of Congress, including a lawsuit filed by a Democratic House member, Chris Van Hollen, in conjunction with some of the campaign finance reform groups, demanding that the IRS do something to crack down on political activities by 501c4s. And I think all of these things coming together, you will remember that when the president fired Stephen Miller in May of this year as the acting commissioner, as the acting commissioner of the IRS, and dispatched his OMB director, Danny Werfel, to become the acting commissioner of the IRS, really one of the primary activities, it appears to me, that Danny Werfel has been involved in since he got to the IRS last May has been to basically conclude and say to Congress and to the world, well, look, you know, bless their little hearts, the IRS agents really didn't know what to do with these groups because there's really no clear definition of what constitutes political activity. And so I think all of those things together have come together. I think that we'll find ultimately that Danny Werfel has been a busy guy at the IRS and that he has spearheaded these proposed regulations. Now, Jason's going to go through and tell you what they do. I want to tell you the process because it's really important. They issue these proposed regulations on November 29th. There is a 90-day comment period, which because of the holidays, we've lost basically a third of it. The comments are due to the IRS by February 27th. And in addition, for those of you who are practitioners, the comments are due to the OMB on the paperwork burden, and those comments are due separately on January 28th. If you want to find these regulations, just Google NPRM IRS regulations social welfare. You'll find it. But it's really important, I think, for practitioners and organizations large and small to weigh in, and it tells you there how to file comments. You can file comments electronically. You can already see those that have been posted. But at this point, I will stop and turn it over to Jason to talk about what is in these proposed regulations.
Sure. I want to talk about the fundamental change they're making to the regulation. The existing regulation says that the promotion of social welfare does not include direct or indirect participation or intervention in political campaigns on behalf of or in opposition to any candidate for public office. Instead, what they're proposing is to revise this regulation to say the promotion of social welfare does not include direct or indirect candidate-related political activity. The IRS leaves some very open questions where they don't even try to give guidance in this NPRM, and I think these are very, very crucial questions. First, they ask whether these rules should apply to charities, trade associations, or labor organizations, which are the 501c3s, the 501c5s, and the 501c6s. This is really important to those of you on the phone who represent trade associations and unions. Trade associations and unions, by their nature, are organizations that are sort of regularly involved in legislative advocacy, wholly apart from anything that a rational person would consider political. And these rules will impact the ability of even these groups to communicate with their members and the public about with their members and with the public about legislation pending in the 30 days before a primary or 60 days before a general. Just to give you an example, the way this proposal is written, if it applied to a trade association or if it applied to a labor union, the 30-day pre-primary rules, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later, suggest that if a labor organization mentions something about Senator McConnell to their members in Oregon in the 30 days before the Kentucky primary, the IRS would treat this as political. So I'm going to take a few minutes and go into some of the details. The first thing they're proposing to do is expand the definition of candidate. Currently, a candidate is somebody who's running for elected office. Now they're saying that in the new definition of candidate, this not only includes people running for elected office, but this also includes individuals that have been nominated for appointed offices, including executive branch and judicial nominations. And again, remember, this is federal, state, and local candidates for these positions. And they also include the phrase persons proposed as candidates. They don't say by who, they don't say in what form, they don't say how. And this is practically an unbounded definition since there are a significant number of private individuals and public officials who've been mentioned in news stories or by opinion columnists as potential candidates for all kinds of offices. You've got Ben Cardin, the private physician from Baltimore. There's, right-wing blogs are out there suggesting he should run for president. Well, does that turn him into a candidate for this definition? Nobody really knows. The other kinds of things that they say will be candidate-related political activity with this expanded definition of candidate includes sort of the traditional express advocacy. Anything that is written, printed, electronic, video, oral communications that, quote, expresses a view, whether for or against, a clearly identified candidate. And the regulation or the proposal suggests that expressing a view is going to be defined either by the traditional Buckley magic words test, the vote for or against, or essentially the Supreme Court's Wisconsin Right to Life definition of express advocacy, which Supreme Court called the functional equivalent of express advocacy, which is that the communication is, quote unquote, susceptible of no other reasonable interpretation other than a call for or against the selection, nomination, election, or appointment of the candidate. So it's a dramatic definition or a dramatic expansion of what constitutes express advocacy. And the way the rule's written, express advocacy any time of the year in any circumstance is per se political. Now they get to some interesting things where they try to borrow from existing FEC rules, but they borrow from these existing FEC rules in a way that doesn't quite capture some of the limitations on the FEC rules. One of the things that they say is that any public communication made within 60 days before a general or 30 days before a primary that clearly identifies a candidate for public office, regardless of how or the context of the communication or the content of the communication, any mention of that candidate in the 30 days before a general or 60 days before a primary constitutes political activity. Whether you're talking about Paul Ryan and Patty Murray negotiating the budget, or whether you're talking about, you know, Mitch McConnell and Allison Grimes, you know, battling it out for the winner of the Tennessee Senate race this fall, any of those occurring within 60 days of the general election, both of those would be automatically political. The 30-60 days was borrowed from the SEC's what they call electioneering communications rules. And under the FEC rules, this 30-60-day window is confined only to broadcast, and it only involves things where you're targeting the communication to the electorate of the candidate who is involved in the ad. This IRS definition doesn't limit it to broadcast, expands it to all forms of communications, and doesn't have any notion that it has to be targeted at the voters. So if somebody were to run an ad in Politico saying, call Senator Reid and tell him to do XYZ, and it was within 30 days of a Nevada primary that Reid was on the ballot for, that communication would be political, even if obviously it had nothing to do with communicating with people in Nevada. It was sort of aimed at the Washington intelligentsia. Doesn't matter. The IRS would deem that political. The other problem here is that this 30-60-day rule essentially covers things that people would think of as genuine issue advocacy, and the IRS acknowledges it. It says this definition would apply without regard to whether public communication is intended to influence the election or some other non-electoral action, such as a vote on pending legislation. They don't even include a media exemption. So an on-air interview by a representative of a C4 who mentions a senator during the interview, or publishing an op-ed for or against the passage of legislation, would turn it into a political communication. Internal membership communications would be covered as long as you were reaching more than 500 people. And they'd also require you to scrub your website, your Facebook page, your Twitter feed of any references to people who are candidates within 30 days of their primary or 60 days of the general, because they're just basically saying, if this stuff still lingers, even if it was posted prior to this 30-60 days, we're gonna deem that political. Lastly, they get into the issue of contributions to candidates and 527 organizations. Those are sort of not ones that people usually would be concerned about. However, they get into the issue of grants. And for those of you who work with nonprofits, nonprofits raise money from other nonprofits all the time and on a regular basis. The IRS is proposing to take the view that if a 501c4 gives to another 501c entity of any kind, and that 501c engages in anything that has been defined as candidate-related political activity, that grant is per se political for the granting organization. If you think about that, that means if you give to a C3 that regularly hosts candidate debates, there's no exemption for that here. So even a C4 giving to a traditional charity, if that traditional charity engages in anything that the C4 rules would deem to be political, could basically taint that entire contribution by the C4 as political. They're also seeking to classify as election-related a bunch of things that almost nobody considers to be political and can be conducted by 501c3s under current rules with tax-deductible dollars, such as voter registration and sort of generic get-out-the-vote drives. So it's pretty stunning and pretty broad. The other sort of major area that the IRS leaves open for comment, and they don't really say what it's going to be, that they say, you know, the organization has to be primarily operated for the purposes of promotion of social welfare, is what their regulation says. And they're asking if the primarily standard should be retained, should there be something else, should they specify some other portion, should they suggest that it's, you know, no more than an insubstantial part, which is the C3 rules, which usually are taken to mean about 5%, or are we talking, you know, 49% is going to be okay? That percentage debate, which they leave wide open in this notice of proposed rulemaking, is probably one of the most significant outstanding questions. Even under these new definitions, if the percentage was high enough, most organizations, including labor unions and trade associations, could live with them. But if they set the percentage very low, it's going to be a real challenge for a lot of organizations to carry out their mission under these rules, where the IRS says if you exceed them, you could lose your tax status. And so with that, I guess I'll turn it over to John.
Thanks, Jason. As Jason said, these rules have taken a somewhat aggressive approach to defining political activity, candidate-related political activity, with the theory that if they cast a net wide enough to capture everything that is going to be at all electoral, indeed capture a lot of things that are not electoral, such as the nonpartisan voter registration and get-out-the-vote activities, then at least they're going to be sure that no organization covered by these regulations is engaged in political activity without it counting against whether or not they're eligible to be tax exempt or whether they pay taxes on it and so forth. But the problem of defining what is or is not political has long preceded this notice of proposed rulemaking. And indeed, a decade or more ago, there were groups of attorneys who practice in the exempt organizations area screaming to the IRS that their existing regulatory framework of we know it when we see it was not sufficient for the organizations regulated to ensure that they're complying with their obligations, and not sufficient for the attorneys and other staff at the IRS charged with regulating this. And I think CLEDA quite clearly and accurately described what happens when there isn't sufficient guidance for the IRS to understand what is and isn't permitted for these tax-exempt organizations that are allowed to engage in, at least to some degree, political activity. Before this notice of proposed rulemaking came out, a number of us who practice in this area of exempt organizations, and in particular those who engage in legislative and political advocacy, sought to do what the IRS seemed at the time unwilling to do, which was to come up with clear rules that would be applicable generally across the spectrum of the tax code to all types of tax-exempt organizations and indeed to for-profit organizations, in a way that would be usable by the regulated community, by the attorneys and accountants who represent them, and indeed by the government officials charged with regulating them. And that was the Bright Lines Project, which I've been involved in. It was organized by Greg Colvin, an attorney at San Francisco's Adler & Colvin, in partnership with my law partner at Harmon Curran, Beth Kingsley. And we've put out a narrower definition of what is candidate-related political activity, or political intervention, as we would call it. Our idea is, rather than cast the wide net that the NPRM has cast, is to really try to focus on what should be treated as political activity, and then acknowledge that there are going to be some things that we're not going to catch, but we're going to catch enough that the regulations will work. So let me just briefly summarize what we would treat under the Bright Lines Project as political activity. There are some activities that will always be political intervention under our plan: endorsing a candidate or political party, contributing to a candidate, to a political party, or to a political committee, Or finally, in the always political intervention category, offering voters some sort of clear litmus test for deciding on which candidates to vote for or vote against. So telling people that they should vote pro-life or vote pro-choice is going to be political intervention under the standard that we're proposing under the Bright Lines Project. Beyond those, however, there's a large category of communications where we're not sure, and so we've offered a threshold test. Is it a communication that clearly refers to and expresses a view on a political candidate? If so, then that should be political intervention unless it fits within one of four specific exceptions that we've developed to protect what we think should be protected as important speech that shouldn't be restricted. First is some of the things that Jason was talking about, legitimate advocacy on current specific actions that an officeholder can take. So if you want to talk critically or in a praising fashion about a particular incumbent candidate, but you're doing so in the context of trying to get him or her to vote a particular way on a live legislative issue or to take a decision in their role as an incumbent executive, then that is okay and not political intervention. Similarly, nonpartisan efforts to educate the public on candidates' policy positions. So we're not talking about a piece of direct mail that clearly attacks a candidate, but rather the sort of side-by-side objective analysis of where the candidates running for a particular office stand. Think League of Women Voters. The third exception that we would allow is measured responses to statements by a candidate either about the organization making the communication or its core issues. And we think of this as the self-defense exception. If you're the ACLU and a presidential candidate makes remarks about the ACLU that cast it in a bad light, you're allowed to respond, and you shouldn't have to worry that the IRS is going to treat that as some sort of surreptitious effort to undermine the candidate who said bad things about you. Our fourth exception would be an exception for speakers at in-person meetings of the organization. The most obvious place for this is churches during services. If you've got a minister in the pulpit preaching, and it's not about running broadcast ads featuring these remarks or putting them up streaming on the internet, but really just a room full of congregants, that shouldn't be something that the IRS should be able to step into and call political activity. Or if it's a PTA meeting, or if it's a membership meeting of an environmental group, all of those should be accepted. This exception doesn't go too far. It's not available if you're going to use it for a mass media advertisement or if you're going to make it more widely available through your website. But at least those in-person meetings would be protected. That is a very quick summary of where we're going. The reason we came up with these is that what has been the current standard, the facts and circumstances standard, the IRS, under which the IRS evaluates a given activity and determines whether or not it's electioneering based on really anything that it wants to think about, was really unworkable. And so our standard has followed the sorts of approaches that have been used to regulate other types of things, most notably the amount of lobbying that 501c3s can do under the regulations at tax code sections 501h and 4911. Clear rules that are susceptible of an average person being able to understand them and know whether or not the activity in question is or is not either lobbying in that case or political activity in this case. So that's what we're pushing. I'm happy to take questions about that or talk about the NPRM or the facts and circumstances standard, but I want to throw it open to the Q&A section.
Thank you all very much. In a moment, we're all going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for one of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got 35 minutes or so left. We've got quite a few people on the phone, so we'll get to as many questions as possible. Let's now go to our first caller.
Hello, this is Paul Solomonk at the University of Kentucky. Thank you for putting on this program. My question goes to, and maybe this isn't within your portfolios, but goes to another approach to all of this. Could you please explain to me what the advantage is of working through a 501c4 for people who do want to get involved in intervention, and why it's infeasible to simply establish for-profit corporations that do this?
Well, we've actually been talking about, among the three of us and another group of attorneys that we meet with monthly, about this very topic of having for-profit entities do these things instead of not-for-profit. I mean, that's one of the problems with this, is that I think any kind of legal challenge to it would say that it's both overbroad and under-inclusive. But, you know, the I think the one downside is that exempt function activities, and I defer to John to some degree on this, but exempt function activities and lobbying activities are not deductible normally for businesses as ordinary and reasonable necessary business expenses. So that has been somewhat of a barrier. But you know, Jason and John both have talked about this very thing and have comments, I think, that they'd like to make on that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems is the non-deductibility. In other words, if you went and collected a bunch of money from people for a business and then spent $100,000 on advertising, because that's non-deductible advertising, the federal government would come and say, you know what, give us our 35% tax. The other problem is if you create an organization whose primary purpose, regardless of its tax status, if you create an organization whose primary purpose is engaging in, let's say, electoral or FEC-regulated activity, regardless of the tax status you choose for the organization, the IRS or the FEC could come in and conclude that that organization is in fact a federal PAC and needs to register and report all of its receipts and disbursements and donations.
I think that's right. I also think that if these regulations prove to be too burdensome, there will be people looking for alternatives to 501c4s. So if, as the NPRM is written, the ultimate regulations apply only to C4s, we will see more use of other types of tax-exempt organizations like the 501c6 form. If the regulations in final form are broadened, we will see groups trying to set it up as for-profit entities where perhaps the money coming into the entity comes in such a way that it wouldn't be subject to the income tax that Jason mentions, or that it engages in enough types of advocacy that it could avoid FEC regulation as having a major purpose of political campaign intervention.
Right. I mean, what you're suggesting is that there may be a flip side to, you know, these groups saying, oh, well, we need, you know, to crack down on these nonprofits. So that the sort of perverse end result may be that other forms of organizations wind up becoming the favored vehicles that are not subject to the exempt organization disclosures and annual tax filings and things like that. And so you may see a lot less publicly than you see now as a result of this.
Yeah, I think there are groups that are very, very concerned about the influence of money in politics and want to see more regulation of that, that thought when they first saw this NPRM that it was going to be a good thing for them. And I think that that's not necessarily true.
Thank you.
Let's take another question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Perhaps we should examine just what difference does it make whether or not an organization receives 501c4 recognition and whether or not they would comply with any of these regulations. Because as I read the code, the only consequence of failing to do so would be that they would have to pay a tax on the less of either the amount they donated to a campaign or their investment income. And all they have to do to avoid a tax liability is have no investment income. So it would seem that there's really no good reason why any organization should ever seek 501c4 status in the first place.
Well, let me break that apart, because one is the question of tax exemption more generally. If the organization is not tax exempt at all, then it is subject to the for-profit taxation, if it's a corporation, corporate taxation. And the tax that you were mentioning, the 527F tax on the lesser of political spending or investment income, only applies to tax-exempt organizations. So, but you are correct that applying for tax-exempt status is something that organizations don't necessarily need to do. They can merely act as tax-exempt organizations and await any choice by the IRS to evaluate whether or not they're meeting those obligations. So all these groups that applied for C4 or 5 or 6 status didn't actually have to get that IRS determination letter. They could have just filed annual tax returns and crossed their fingers and hoped that the IRS didn't audit them and question that fact.
But well, the fact that they're nonprofit would seem to be a determining factor. What is the claim of the IRS to be able to tax organizations that don't make money?
Well, the IRS, there are a lot of businesses that don't make money that are nonetheless taxable corporations. The nonprofit corporate status of an organization based on a state nonprofit corporation act is not determinative. It is a question of whether or not you meet the requirements of 501c4 or 5 or 6 or C whatever to determine whether or not you're exempt from federal income tax under the exempt organization section of the tax code.
That's right. And one of the things that you need to think about is that if you don't meet the tax exempt, you do not have to get a letter of recognition of exempt status or letter of determination of exempt status to operate as an exempt organization. But in order to escape the liability, the income tax liability, these groups file every year, even if they don't have a letter of determination, they file a Form 990, which is an information return rather than an income tax return. But they file an information return with the IRS in which they have to describe to the IRS their expenditures and their income and expenditures, and to demonstrate that they are operating in accordance with their stated mission, which is to comply with the requirements for functioning as a 501c4 or whatever the tax code provision is. So that's where this will manifest itself, is that organizations that are 501c4s will have to file every year their 990. Some of them will have letters of determination, some will not. And they will have to file with the IRS and disclose to the IRS. They'll have to keep records, which is the paperwork burden that the IRS, by the way, in this rulemaking has said, oh, well, there's no paperwork burden. There's an enormous paperwork burden on groups small and large, because they will have to keep books that will calculate all the things Jason was outlining, and we've really just scratched the surface on the types of things that would be affected. All legislative voting records that an organization might post on its website, those have to come down within the window, and the window can be all the time. We don't know that because these are so inartfully drafted. Some would say malevolently drafted, but they'll have to report to the IRS, well, this is how much we spent in expenditures on this new area of candidate-related political activities, and that cannot count toward the group's primary purpose. And so not only do you risk the issue of taxation, well, now you also risk that they also run the risk, if they don't have a majority of their activities and expenditures in whatever would be left for a C4 to do, that would not qualify as a candidate-related political activity. If they don't meet that, then they are converted. They could conceivably be converted to a 527 political organization. That's unclear as well. I mean, all of this is unclear, but those of us who practice in this area are looking and seeing, well, this is what normally has happened. Is that what's going to happen here?
The only good news about this.
I think that actually if an organization lost its status, I think it would be converted to a taxable entity and have to pay taxes, again, subject to all of the non-deductibility and everything we just talked about. So a group could wind up losing its tax-exempt status and have a significant tax burden that, frankly, it probably just couldn't pay because it never anticipated it, which puts all of the director, all the folks who volunteer to help out with organizations, suddenly their organization that they're on the board of is facing a tax lien from the IRS. And you could see where that could get really personally ugly for the people that were involved in these.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay, what about donations? Are they considered gifts, or are they considered income?
Good question. We don't know. some of you who have been following this area will know that the same Steve Miller who got who lost his job, shall we say, in the course of the IRS scandal that broke last spring, before that decided to get out of trouble with regard to the gift tax as it applied to C4 donors by basically waving his hands and issuing a letter saying, from this point forward, until we think about it some more, the IRS is not going to say that any C4 donor has made a gift for purposes of that donor's gift tax liability. Of course, the IRS could change that unilateral ruling at any time. As to whether or not the organization would have to treat the income as gift or income, we don't know the answer to that. Some of the strategies that have been talked about in various trade publications or in meetings about how to structure the post-NPRM organization would be to create organizations where the contributions are either capital to the organization and therefore not income, or to create some other structure that would avoid having the money come in as income.
I just want to add one other background, just for those of you who think the IRS might be pure. The issue about the gift tax from C4s from a couple of years ago that Steve Miller was involved in came out in the wake of the IRS scandal that all five of the donors who received, and there were only five across the country who received essentially notices of inquiry from the IRS about their gift taxes, they were all donors to a 2008-based conservative organization that existed in 2008 called Freedom Squash. So literally the only five people in the whole country that got the gift tax sort of were looking at you notices all happened to have been donors to Freedom's Watch. So, you know, add that to how the IRS views donors to conservative groups and how they've treated conservative groups
in the past. And there have been occasional attempts to enforce gift tax other than that, but that was the thing that precipitated Steve Miller's reaction. We're never quite sure what happened there. It may be that Freedom's Watch was under examination or pre-examination at the IRS, and some smart Johnny decided that he was going to refer to the gift tax piece of the IRS, which is actually different from the exempt organizations branch. So we'll never know.
Because the IRS isn't very forthcoming about things when they're being investigated, I can tell you.
Well, I will say that they are... With notable exceptions, with which Cleta is all too familiar, the IRS is actually prohibited from releasing a lot of taxpayer information, and it's frustrating when they do.
We've got a couple more questions pending. Let me ask before we go to the next caller, is this proposed regulation, is this something that's raising alarm bells on both sides of the aisles, or groups from all over the spectrum?
Well,
as
the token other side of the aisle on this call, let me take a shot at that. Most of my clients are central to progressive organizations, most of them advocacy organizations. A lot of them are concerned, and there are definitely groups that think, even those groups that think the IRS should better define political activity, thinks that they've gone overboard in this NPRM and are filing comments to that effect.
And I think that what's interesting, John and I were talking about this earlier this week, that the conservative groups think that this is a I happen to think that this is a concerted effort by the Obama administration to find some other way to crack down on all these pesky citizen Tea Party groups who cost them control of the House in 2010. But that's probably, as I say, just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get me and my clients. But
I think that there is a distaste for among many politicians for independent groups that say things
them.
That make the politicians uncomfortable on the left and the right.
Well, and that's what I was going to say, is that I think that it's going to be very interesting because there's a letter before we got on this call signed by 55 conservative groups that's gone to all the House members, probably just the House Republicans, but saying you've got to do something to stop this. And at the same time, I think that, you know, some on the left may think that this is caused by people on the right. People on the right think it's caused by people on the left. But the fact of the matter is, there's a in the effort to try to limit actual political activities, there's a lot of collateral damage. And mm-hmm. normal and ordinary, and just to put it in context, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has announced it plans to spend $50 million in primary campaigns in 2014. And that would not be covered by any of these proposed regulations. But a local citizens group that sets up a voter registration booth at the county fair, which never mentions a candidate, and just tries to just registers voters and encourages people to get out to vote, that is counted as candidate-related political activity and would have to be tracked, calculated, reported to the IRS, and would not count toward their exempt purpose. And I just think there's something inherently crazy about that.
Yeah, I also think there are a lot of groups that are just not aware of this. First of all, it came out just before Thanksgiving. And second, it says that it's only about C4s, and a lot of C3s and C5s and C6s are saying, well, I don't have to worry about that. I think that's an incredible mistake.
I agree with that. I met with a C4 group yesterday, and they told me, this is a conservative C4 grassroots group, and they told me, we don't engage in any political activities. We have a PAC, and we do all of our political activities through our PAC. So we don't do any of those things. We just do grassroots lobbying, and we just do candidate debates and candidate forums and all. And I said, they said, this doesn't affect us. I said, oh, contraire. You need to understand. And I had to go through with them, and they were horrified. But their first reaction was, well, we don't do any political activity, so it doesn't affect us.
Let's turn to another caller now. We've got three questions pending, so.
This is Will Estrada with the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. Thank you for this great information. My question is, what are your thoughts about whether the IRS has this legal ability to promulgate this proposed rule? I know that there have been bills introduced in Congress that would kind of do some of these same things. So is this an issue of where they're kind of going beyond their legal authority, or do you think they do have the legal authority to come up with this proposed rule?
You know, the Heritage Foundation submitted a comment suggesting that they don't have the authority to do this because their regulation that says the promotion of social welfare doesn't include political campaign intervention as it's currently crafted, or this candidate-related political activity as they're proposing to define it. You know, the Heritage Foundation is essentially making the argument that the IRS didn't have the authority to do this, or doesn't have the authority to say the political activity isn't social welfare. The problem is that regulation is really old, and since the IRS enacted that regulation, Congress reauthorized the statute without changing the regulation. So I think the IRS is probably in a good position to say that they have the authority to make rules in this area. Whether the courts are going to come in and say, look, what you're doing here, you know, violates the First Amendment for some other reasons, you know, I think is a real open question, depending on how far the IRS goes. But I think on the fundamental question of whether the IRS can regulate in this area, I think the IRS probably wins in the end.
Well, I would like to say that I think that maybe that's an arguable question, simply because I think that the IRS, and maybe not so much arguable question, but I think it is one of the things that bothers me as a conservative is that I think Congress too often delegates too much authority to administrative agencies. And one of the things that I would like to see happen in my lifetime is that Congress assert itself as a legislative body instead of allowing executive branch agencies to do its job. And I think that Congress needs to act in this area. But I do think that there is an arguable case to be made that the IRS has without any intervening legislative change, proceeded to make substantial changes to the regulations, and substantive changes that are not authorized by any congressional directive or authorization. So I think that Congress ought to act and to say that social welfare does include voter registration, get-out-the-vote activities, nonpartisan activities in that regard, candidate debates, candidate forums, I mean, the kinds of things. Actually, the Bright Lines Project does specifically address some of those things, but I think Congress ought to weigh in as well.
I think it would be great if Congress weighs in, but I have to say I agree with Jason that it would be a very heavy lift to argue that the regs promulgated after this NPRM are somehow improper on that basis. I think there might be constitutional arguments, as Jason alluded to, but I think that the IRS appears to have the authority to do this.
All right, let's check in with another caller.
Hi, my name's Thelma Tormina, and I actually run a 501c4 in Houston, and it is a conservative group, and I've watched everything that's going on. My question is, really, is there a need to change these regulations? Because it was very clear to me we could choose between a C3 or a C4, and being that we wanted to weigh in mostly on legislative actions, we went with the C4 so that we were sure that we would never go over the 25% that they allow the C3s to do.
For lobbying, you could do that. But in terms of political activity, which is what these regulations try and do, activity that might be deemed to help or hurt the election of a candidate, there really hasn't been very good guidance. And it has been a problem for a number of organizations, although perhaps not yours. I get a lot of calls as a practitioner every election year from groups that hear candidates talking about the issue that they are focused on, the groups are focused on, and they want to respond, and they don't know whether or not they can. And under the current facts and circumstances standard, it often isn't clear how safe they are in doing that. So doing something in this area, I think, would be valuable. I think this is a very kind of meat cleaver approach, unfortunately.
I think this just captures the point that you just made. You know, you engage in grassroots activity related to legislation. Well, now if you do anything within 30 days of the Texas primary or 60 days of the general election, every communication that you do that mentions or refers to somebody who happens to be running for office is suddenly now political as far as the IRS is concerned.
Right.
Regardless of whether your ad or your email says, you know, call them and tell them to vote against the tax bill.
Or if you have on your website legislative voting records, you have to take that down. And like I said, it's unclear when you have to take it down or whether you can ever have it up again. Because if you, unless you don't mind having it counted as candidate-related political activity. So the basic functions of 501c4 organizations to lobby for issues and to advocate issues and to engage in grassroots organization lobbying and advocacy, I mean, all of that is swept into this, which is, by the way, the stated purpose is to create clarity. And that is Orwellian at best to say that this somehow creates clarity.
Yeah, because here's my problem with the way that they're doing it. A 501c4 nonprofit is supposed to be for social welfare. Well, if some rule or regulation has been passed that actually goes against the public welfare, and you're trying to get that message out, then your freedom of speech is going to be limited. And I heard the comment earlier, don't bother to be a nonprofit 501c4. But in reality, we are a small group that was created by two individuals, married couple, who don't have a lot of money, and we rely on small donations, $25 a year, to be able to do what we do, and the IRS would virtually make it impossible with this new rule for us to be able to do what we do.
Well, I do hope that you're planning. I do hope you're planning to submit comments.
Oh, I am.
And I also would tell everybody. It occurred to me yesterday that everybody should not wait until February 27th because it is a .gov website, and I just worry that it will crash, and all the comments will be lost.
Well, you know, the other thing I'd say, you know, for your organization, the other thing that's going to be absolutely critical for the outcome of this rulemaking and its impact on you is what percentage of this candidate-related political activity you're allowed to do. If they come back and tell you it's 49%, you may be okay. If they come back and tell you it's 2%, you may have a real problem.
Which is the whole reason why we went C4.
And that's the appropriate, and that is the appropriate, that's the other thing. That is the appropriate tax status for a group of citizens who wish to engage in the public policy debate, and they don't meet any of the more specialized categories under the tax code. I mean, the social welfare moniker or category is really a bit of a catch-all, but it is what is the appropriate tax status, tax code provision for groups like yours, people who want to have an impact on public policy. And historically, you know, the rule being, well, you know, yes, you know, they can engage in some political activities because, as the Supreme Court said in Buckley versus Vallejo, 1976, it's very difficult to tell. It's impossible to tell at what point do discussions about issues morph into discussions about candidates. I mean, that's exactly what the Supreme Court has noted, and that's, we all know that.
We've got a few minutes remaining and a couple questions on the board, so let's go to our next caller.
This is Eddie Grime in Kansas City at the law firm of Graves Garrett. And I've got a question about, I think it may be an intersection between the proposed regulations and something we're seeing increasingly on the campaign finance side. Sort of the new flavor of the month or of the year is this whole theory of when does something become a contribution because of coordination with the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just I did not realize this before looking at the regs, but I'm just looking at the summary on the IRS website, but they've got two different things. One of them is they tie into things that have to be reported to the FEC. And so if the federal government, if they ever get around to having a more detailed or an enforceable coordination standard, that might be a backdoor for this to now, you know, rope in a bunch of C4s. But second, it's this category that they call activities closely related to elections or candidates. It talks about material distribution of material prepared by mm-hmm. or on behalf of a candidate or a Section 527 PAC. So I guess my concern is, and I wanted to know if anyone shares this, don't we have a potentially massive problem here, especially at the state and local level, where we have these groups that are out there, they've got a local school board issue or who knows what it is, and suddenly they're coordinating with candidates without knowing it?
Well, I think that, you know, there are a couple of problems with the way and how are you doing, Eddie? Nice to hear from you. But there are a couple of ways that I think that these proposed rules are problematic in the portions that you've referenced. Number one, I mean, let's say, because the rules are so poorly, the proposals are so poorly drafted, let's say you have a group of a Tea Party group that says, or any citizens group that says, all right, we want to encourage all of our members to go volunteer for candidates. You know, we don't care who you volunteer for, but, you know, we want, as part of your civic engagement, we want you to go volunteer for candidates. Now, if those people go to show up at the school board or somebody's campaign, local campaign, any campaign, these volunteers and say, you know, well, we're here at the, you know, we're here to help distribute leaflets. Well, now, does that become a reportable expenditure by the group that encouraged its members to go volunteer for candidates? Presumably the way that's written, yes, because one of the things that, in addition to expenditures by a C4 organization, they also have to come up with some manner of calculating volunteer activity.
Right.
And there's no definition given for that. It's just you have to include it in your calculation of reportable candidate-related political activity. And another area that you point out or you raise is under the FEC regulations, if you're an organization, a corporation, a nonprofit corporation that has a your membership organization and you have a connected PAC. So, for instance, the National Right to Life organization has a connected PAC. Susan B. Anthony List has a connected PAC. Well, under the FEC regulations, none of the expenditures that the connected organization makes in terms of administering the PAC, raising money for the PAC. None of that is reportable to the FEC. So it wouldn't be captured under that definition, but the other portion of the proposed regs that you mentioned, it would be captured under because it would be deemed to be an expenditure in relationship to a PAC. A PAC is a 527 committee. So now suddenly these are candidate-related political activities, even though it's just for the support of their own PAC. So there are so many hidden minefields in these proposed regulations that it's really important for people to weigh in.
Let me just offer a caution here. We've got about 4 minutes left in this. I'm afraid this is going to have to be our final question.
Hi, David Tryon, attorney at Porter Wright in Cleveland, Ohio. And unions, as I understand it, unions are generally considered to be 501c4 organizations. And
no,
501c5. Unions are 5c5.
Okay, well then, that was my question, if the unions are going to object to this in any way. It sounds like not.
Well,
not
I mean,
covered.
I think the unions are probably going to weigh in and say, hey, this shouldn't apply to us.
And
yeah,
I think the C6
if
is
you're
going
the
to
AFL-CIO and you're looking at this and you're thinking, oh my, if they apply this to me, we got problems.
Right.
Let's then try and take one more question.
Hi, Jim Markowski, lawyer in New York. Wouldn't these regulations potentially make the activities of the Federal Society not tax exempt, given the natures of the discussions they have and the timing, et cetera?
If they apply it to C3s, yeah, even organizations like the Federalist Society are going to have to wrestle with whether they have to change their programming and their communications and everything they do to avoid engaging in candidate-related political activity if the IRS actually applies this to C3s.
Well, just remember that these proposed regulations would create now we would have a whole new set of regulations that would apply just to C4s if adopted the way they've been published. And so you have one set of regulations defining candidate-related political activities, that's for C4s, and then you have exempt activities that under Code Section 527, and you have another set of regulations and revenue rulings and interpretive guidance over many years for what is heretofore and currently known as partisan campaign intervention. So you have three different sets of rules and regulations, you know, and this is supposed to further clarity? I don't think so.
And God help the groups that have both a C3 and a sister C4 who have to keep juggling these balls and keep track of all these different definitions.
And the question becomes whether or not candidate-related political activities are subject to the tax that we talked about earlier that is imposed for exempt activities or partisan campaign intervention, are now these going to be subject to taxation or not? And we don't know the answer to that, but presumably then we would have to keep 2 to 3 sets of books for each C4.
Well, before you all put the Federal Society out of business, let me optimistically announce that next week we have scheduled a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum. Monday at 2 p.m. We'll be covering the Noel Canning recess appointment power case with a special expert who's going to attend oral argument. And then likewise, Wednesday at 2 p.m., another Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum, this one discussing the McCullen versus Coakley. It's the sidewalk protest case being argued that day in the Supreme Court. It's obviously possible we'll add more calls along the way, so please check our website for an update to the calendar. But today, of course, my thanks to Ms. Cleta Mitchell, Mr. John Pomerantz, and Mr. Jason Torchinsky. This has been a fascinating discussion. I think there are still questions that we haven't answered, and maybe we can reconvene after the comment period just to find out what's going on. So thank you all for your time today. To our audience, I encourage you to join us for our next scheduled call Monday at 2 p.m., but until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.